Investors and companies know that climate smart policy spurs business and investment that ultimately helps the private sector meet their ambitious climate goals. President Biden has presented his ambitious infrastructure plan, which incorporates his economic vision for the future, which apparently prioritizes building a sustainable infrastructure and one that mitigates against the ravages of climate change. It also fosters clean energy innovation and creates skilled jobs. But what jobs will it create? What specifically is in it? What incentives are in it or requirements for sustainable and climate resilient infrastructure? Well, today we're going to find out from someone who has had a front row seat to these efforts for many years. Welcome to the new Electric Ladies podcast, formerly known as Green Connections Radio. We bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women about corporate responsibility, energy, and sustainability-related issues. I'm your host, Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers in these STEM fields, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts on our website, the new electricladiespodcast.com. And through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. If you are struggling in your own career, especially in this craziness, please reach out to me on Twitter and let me know. We can help you. I do career coaching and doesn't matter what industry you're in. So what is in this infrastructure plan? What is repairing or replacing bridges, roads, and mass transit in sustainable ways? How does it really require infrastructure to be climate resilient? What does it do for clean energy? And on and on and on. Today, as I said, we have the perfect person to ask. I'd like you to meet Ann Kelly, the Vice President of Government Relations at the venerable nonprofit Ceres. She also leads the Ceres Policy Network and the Business for Innovative Climate and Energy Policy. Exactly the topic. See, I told you it was the right person to talk to. Ceres leverages its extensive network of the business community and policymakers to drive market and policy-based strategies for the planet. Anne brings 25 years of experience across the industry, from being a lawyer bringing legal actions against polluters and the like with the Massachusetts-based Environmental Crimes Strike Force, how do you like that, to working at the EPA. In addition to her law degree, she also has a master's in public administration from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Full disclosure, I have known Anne for several years, and I'm thrilled to finally have a chance to have her on our show. Welcome to Electric Ladies.
Thank you so much, Joan.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm thrilled. So I want to start with your giving us an overview of the infrastructure plan as you understand it. You know, what do you see is specifically in it, and what do you think the priorities are?
Well, thanks so much, Joan. And it's a pretty comprehensive plan. And I think the general theme to keep in mind for your viewers is that this is very much a jobs plan. But there's no question in the minds of anyone who's read it or in the administration that the belief behind the plan is that it deals with really four interwoven challenges that the administration is facing. And of course, the first is the post-pandemic reality. The second is the economic downturn. The third is the climate crisis. And the fourth is inequality and racial equity and the disproportionate environmental harm and other harms that have been placed on low-income communities and communities of color. Now, not putting those in any kind of a priority, they're all of the utmost importance, but the general theme is that the road to economic recovery is through climate action. And so it is an infrastructure and a jobs plan, but there's no question that it very intentionally addresses the climate crisis in a number of ways. And know that the Biden administration signaled his plans. He's been remarkably consistent with the messages of last summer. If you saw the clean energy Biden plan, he had a whole blueprint around clean energy and environmental justice, and he has come through with flying colors in this plan. You know, first and foremost, it really is a building up of the clean energy sector, the job generating clean energy sector. And the lesson from 2009, as you all know now from the stimulus that then Vice President Biden worked on, it just was simply not enough funding. It wasn't enough funding, and it wasn't enough for the clean energy sector. So this is going to largely come through in the form of an array of renewable energy tax credits of various forms, which are wildly popular and successful. Those are really important and will certainly get the support of the business community. There's something called a direct pay provision that is important to renewable energy developers for those who may not have the adequate tax equity to benefit from a tax incentive that's built into the whole thing. At this point, I want to say that there's something called Justice 40, which is outlined from the very beginning. President Biden made it clear that 40% of the benefits of his investments would go to underserved, frontline, disadvantaged communities. Justice 40 calls for that in no uncertain terms, that the benefits that come from his plan will definitely be moved. 40% of those will be directed at these communities. Now, what are those benefits? Well, the administration is looking at both qualitative and quantitative benefits towards frontline communities. This is an extremely thoughtful process, not something they're taking lightly. So know that that is a cornerstone element of the plan. There's also a big element around transportation. So we know that transportation emissions have now eclipsed those coming from the power sector. We know that very soon the U.S. is going to set an interim climate goal pursuant to our rejoining the Paris Agreement that is likely to be at or near 50% reduction by 2030 based on a 2005 baseline. So it's a major reduction goal. That really provides the foundation for a whole suite of climate policies that we are about to see. So I mentioned that because it's timely, Joan. I'm not sure exactly when this particular conversation will air, but no doubt by the time we are talking to your audience, we will know what that interim goal is. If we're going to make that goal, we've got to go after the biggest sources of emissions. So the plan really looks at the transforming our transportation system, to electrifying transportation, to the purchase of electric vehicles, to the build out of electric vehicle infrastructure in a major, major way. So we'll certainly look for that. And again, that's one of those job generating elements. It's got some bread and butter elements. It's got repairing roads and bridges. And we know that those are important to red, blue, and purple states. Those are just simply job generating. It's got some things that I think are particularly important to rural communities in red states. And that would include high-speed broadband, which is a wonderful crossover issue that I think is important. And that has been talked about by Republicans for a long time. So those are just a few. It also, of course, calls for grid modernization, which is essential. If you're contributing to a clean energy economy, you have to upgrade the grid and make it responsive. And there's all kinds of needs there to improve the grid. All of what the president has put forward is job generating. And if I know some of your listeners are wondering about the cost of this, let me say at the outset that if you're thinking to put the cost in context, one has to think about the cost of inaction when it comes to climate change.
Well, you also have to think about the money that will be generated from it. For example, what a lot of people may not know, and I was surprised really wasn't talked about much, was that the investments in clean energy innovations from the recovery plan and other, frankly, investments from the clean energy, from the recovery plan, Recovery Act in 2008-2009, generated more money than the Recovery Act cost. And people don't realize that. It's like also people talk about the bailout, quote unquote, bailout of the automakers. Actually, the government made, I may be wrong on this, but I think it was like $35 billion on that deal. It was like, and I worked for Chrysler in the electric cars. I mean, that's how I got into this space. So I know about the jobs that were saved. So it's creating jobs. And of course, when you get a job, you're paying taxes and the employer's paying taxes. So there's money that you, it's not just a cost. It's not just the cost of not doing anything. It's actually that it will generate real revenue. And that's part of why the Congressional Budget Office numbers and other people's numbers and Moody's numbers, et cetera, are interesting to watch also. They're not, you don't know because we don't know what will actually happen, right? But there's also, they're really, you can't miss the fact that it's actually going to be generating real revenue.
You're absolutely right. You make the case effectively, and the Biden administration should hire you to make that case because you're absolutely right. I can already feel my own defensiveness as I'm going to be on the front lines on Capitol Hill soon, defending this as we bring our business leaders to Capitol Hill on May 11th and 12th to make the case for sustainable infrastructure. But you're exactly right. There's no question about the job generating nature of what's being proposed, about the revenue generating nature of what's being proposed. And this is a formula that has been tried and true. It's happened before. And so it's a wise investment across the board. For sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to clarify a couple of things. One is, since I obviously have a particular passion for electric vehicles, it's funny, I just bought a car, but I couldn't buy a fully electric car because I'm in a condo building and they don't have charging. So is there anything in this bill that will address multifamily housing units and maybe require them and then fund fulfilling that requirement to put in charging stations? Now, the tricky part is, you know, they just give you parking spaces. They don't give them to you based on which parking spaces are electric and which are, I mean, you have to, that's a whole nother logistical thing. But is there money in there to help multifamily dwellings become put in infrastructure also?
You know, that's a good question, Joan. I don't know if it gets that granular, to be honest with you. There is a tremendous commitment to build out EV infrastructure so that it's convenient for the American people in any number of locations. I wouldn't be surprised if we get to the point where there becomes to have a requirement that may also be mandated at the state level, where it becomes required for multifamily houses, multifamily units to provide EV infrastructure in EV charging. It's an excellent suggestion. I'm happy to pass it along to my friends in the administration, because I think there's going to be many people in your position.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I totally get that. The other is, you mentioned the Justice 40, which I adore. I'm a little confused. Is that 40% of the allocations will go to those communities? Or is it that you said something about the benefits of it or the proceeds of it? So explain that a little bit.
Yeah, and some of the administration officials I've spoken to are still in the thick of working out what exactly this will mean. So 40% of the benefits that come from the infrastructure plan, and that includes investments and other new programs, will be directed toward disadvantaged communities and communities of color. Now, what is that actually going to mean? I honestly think that that's still being talked about. I'm not sure that has exactly taken shape, but there's no question about the central nature of the plan being focused on the needs of these communities. And there's a variety of needs, including bringing them to the table when decisions are made, including there's legacy issues within some of these communities, you know, long-term enforcement problems, air quality, public health, the lack of air quality monitors. We could go on and on. And I am impressed. I have met with many administration departments, and every single person I have met with has mentioned equity front and center in their remarks. There's a new person who is, you know, Director of Energy Justice, Dr. Shalonda Baker, incredibly, you know, brilliant woman who's doing a new position within DOE. They never had a Director of Energy Justice before.
No.
So it's a new day. It's a new day, and they're moving quickly. And it's just an impressive amount of work that I'm seeing from the administration.
Oh, that's great. That's just terrific. So I want to go back a little bit to a little bit of basics. Talk about what exactly is sustainable infrastructure. What does that really mean?
So sustainable infrastructure is really thought of as infrastructure that's going to withstand the ravages of time. It's going to be resilient, essentially. So it's infrastructure that is, first off, if it's built from scratch, it's built with sustainable materials. And so this administration is very sensitive to sustainable procurement and putting a value on those suppliers who can bring, let's say, sustainable cement and sustainable products right from the get-go. So you're building with a more sustainable, environmentally sensitive product. And you're building in a way that it will actually withstand extreme weather events and extreme temperatures. And so there is that is a huge spectrum of infrastructure that goes from natural infrastructure to human-made infrastructure that needs to be designed for the next 50 to 100 years.
Wow.
And that's true in coastal communities, and it's true in other communities. And just given the extreme weather disasters we have seen just in these last 2 years, that gives you an insight as to what is actually needed. You know, we also have some pretty basic repairs that we have to make in roads and bridges that are falling apart, where we just need to build them up. And as we build them up, we have to keep in mind the extreme weather events that we can anticipate based on all the modeling that has proven to demonstrate that, you know, climate change may be happening even faster than we thought.
Well, it seems to be happening faster than we thought. You know, that's so interesting because these people keep rebuilding in these places that keep happening. I mean, I just got to tell you, I don't know that I could rebuild in a place where I lost a home because of a hurricane when you know that they get hurricanes like that all the time. I mean, I don't know that I could do it. And so if we can help these people rebuild in a way that lets them keep their home and be safe through these events, that's like a modern miracle to me.
Exactly. Exactly. So that they are not displaced.
Yes. And the costs that come from that. I mean, I interviewed somebody and I did this research. I can't remember what the exact number is, but it's something like, some crazy number, like $200 billion we've spent on extreme weather event emergency costs, whether it's housing, you know, repair, et cetera, et cetera. And so, again, it goes into running those numbers. You know, you can't just run the numbers of the actual cost.
No, right. I mean, what you just said is really important. I fear the opposition will be taking numbers out of context. And so it's really important to look at the numbers that have come from the disasters we've just been through. So you're right. One has to really look at this in a holistic way.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that there's, and of course, don't get me started on FEMA and their problems. So you mentioned that these infrastructure, sustainable infrastructure would mitigate climate change. Is there anything else in there that is, and obviously if you're doing clean energy innovations, that's designed to stop the emissions that contribute to climate change. But is there anything else in there that specifically mitigates climate change or addresses climate change?
It's more about rebuilding and it's about resilience and it's about job generation. And I guess the most direct emissions reduction play there's really two things. One, it's electrifying transportation will lead to emissions reduction per se.
Absolutely.
And that will lead to reduction in climate change. Secondly, the building up of the clean energy sector. You know, the federal government has invested in major projects historically, right? The building up of the clean energy sector will help to modernize the grid, and a cleaner grid will lead to fewer emissions and therefore slow the pace of climate change. I think those are the two things that are most direct. Now, in terms of other emissions reductions, we have to remember that we've got the administrative end of things. This is a legislative package. Remember that the administration itself will be putting out fuel economy standards. Those need to be stringent for the internal combustion engines that we're still going to have on the roads for the next 15 years before everything electrifies. They're really important. Secondly, methane regulation is of the utmost importance. We've seen the methane numbers that are just staggering lately. That's really important, but that is a separate rulemaking process that the administration will take on its own.
Cool. Speaking of standards, thank you for that perfect segue. I saw that 310 business leaders and investors signed a letter supporting a federal climate target to reduce emissions. So you kind of alluded to this a little bit ago in your overview of the plan, but talk a little bit about is that what the fuel economy standards that you're talking about, or is that renewable energy standards? I mean, there's been a request for, let's put it this way, there's been discussion about federal renewable energy standards for a long time because many states have them, but there's no federal one. So is it a federal renewable energy standard, or what exactly is it that they're asking for?
Well, let me describe what the company signed on to, and the outpouring of support was really pretty stunning. I invite your listeners to take a look at that. It's been published widely this past week. It was to call for the U.S. climate target under the terms of the Paris Agreement. So rejoining the Paris Agreement was important, but more important was to then step up to the plate and establish the 2030 emissions reduction goal for all industrialized countries, the US included. Now we know that we have a net zero goal for 2050, but there needs to be an interim goal at 2030. And what the letter said, and what our modeling has proved is that the U.S. can, in fact, bring our emissions down to a 50% reduction by 2030 using a 2005 baseline. In fact, the modeling suggested we could probably reach about 53% reduction by 2030. So notice something, Joan, this is interesting because most of us don't remember particularly well under the Obama administration when the climate goal was established. You may remember it was 26 to 28% reduction by 2025 based on a 2005 baseline. And that was, you know, that was passed and important. This one has generated an enormous amount of support, not just from businesses and investors, but also scientists weighing in, small businesses have weighed in, civil society has weighed in to say, this is really important as a foundational matter. Because if you have this goal as a requirement, part of our role in the Paris Agreement, what you're doing is really setting the foundation for a whole suite of policies within Building Back Better, within the regulations that I mentioned. And if companies themselves, many of them have set their own interim goals. We all know if you want to make progress, you can't set it so far off in 2050, you got to get to work right now. You allude to something else, however, that's important, which is a clean electricity standard. Yeah. And yes, that has also been proposed. And yes, they've been enormously successful in 30 states across the country. We hope that we will see one at the US level, at the federal level as well, that has been talked about for years. This is going to be part of the negotiations. And yes, that would lead to emissions reductions because, of course, power companies would be required to have part of their portfolio strictly be renewable energy. And the definitions of renewable energy are important too. But that would be a major step. And certainly we'll be talking about that on Capitol Hill as well. So it's part of the mix.
Are they going to be enforceable, though? Because part of the thing with the Paris Accord is that there's no enforcement mechanism. So, you know, it's you can pledge and you can commit and you can say, yes, I will, and then go eat your chocolate cake, right? So what is there to enforce, to hold? Because you work with the business community, right? And I kind of serve as a liaison with the business community in this. So the business community works on a framework, and that's, you know, regulations do drive investment. Ergo, you know, all the clean energy, alternative energy vehicles we see coming out the last 10 years and 5 years and in the next 5 years as well. So what is there, if there's no enforcement mechanism, it doesn't have any teeth.
It is in fact a goal, just like the earlier one under the Obama administration. It is a goal. All countries are being asked to establish a public goal, now underscoring the public interim goal. With that as a goal, it's a level of trust with your other industrialized neighbors. Now, Canada is going to be coming out with theirs. Japan is going to be coming out with theirs. It's actually pretty important that there is the peer pressure to come up with a strong goal. And then you establish people in order to make that goal. What do you have to do? Well, you have to have enforceable standards. You have to have enforceable laws in place. And so that's why I said it sets the foundation that then enables and really creates the foundation for actual enforceable laws and regulations that need to follow. Now, that doesn't mean we can go to sleep after this goal gets set. All the things I mentioned, we got to be working Capitol Hill, we got to be pushing the administration, we got to be weighing in on draft rules. So we certainly have our work cut out for us, because you're exactly right. If these standards aren't enforceable, then they are not going to have as much meaning.
Well, and we have to vote our values too. I mean, there's this little thing called an election in 2022 next year. So, and it's unfortunately going to be harder than ever to vote. I want to ask you a couple things more, and then I want to ask you a career question. We like to give some career advice. One of the bugaboos in this whole that's behind the shadows that a lot of people in the normal public don't know is disclosure is a black box, or I should say it's a crapshoot, maybe is a better analogy. I mean, you can, because of their lack of standards. So there's no, I mean, the World Economic Forum, GRI, and SASB, the Sustainable Accounting Standards Board, are collaborating to create some standards of a uniform standard of sorts, or a standard of standards, however you define it. And the markets are paying attention, because I don't know if you noticed, the World Economic Forum this year was ESG on steroids. I mean, it was like every session was on, and I wrote about this a lot in Forbes, in fact. But disclosure is a problem. And the company, the 310 companies and investors that signed your letter, probably each have their own version of disclosure, and it's too easy to hide what you want to hide and rant and, you know, be all excited and draw attention to the one thing that you want to everybody to applaud you for. So how do we get a more uniform, consistent level of disclosure? And how do we tackle this beast?
Yeah, I'm so happy that you asked this question, because I think you probably know, Joan, that this is something that's been of the utmost importance to Ceres, at least for the last 12 years. So if we narrow your question a little bit to be about climate disclosure.
That's what I meant. I'm sorry. Climate disclosure. Yeah.
Let's zero right in on climate risk disclosure, where we have very good news to report. And just in the last few months, we were thrilled to see the Federal Reserve come out and identify climate risk as a systemic financial risk, which, of course, Ceres has been publishing about for a very long time. In addition, you may know that a couple of weeks ago, the SEC came out and asked for public comments writ large in a 90-day comment period that goes until mid-June about, well, what should the SEC do when it comes to mandatory climate risk disclosure? Give us your thoughts, give us your ideas, which is a really good, smart, democratic way to approach the public when you're about to write a new draft rule. So you are going to see a cascade of comments from the business and investor community about, well, what do we actually need? What have we learned from TCFD, from SASB, from GRI, from all these other voluntary reporting schemes that have been robust? And there's been such an important history of learning through them. How do we get decision useful, comparable information to investors so that they can make the decisions they need to make? The SEC is going to have a tremendous amount of information from the public who's going to weigh in between now and mid-June. And then they're going to take that and they're going to draft a rule around mandatory climate risk disclosure. I think you know that the Biden administration, again, keeping its word, has signaled for months that they intend to require mandatory climate risk disclosure. And I think we will hear from them in very short order, even before that draft rule, about their commitment along these lines. I'm sure you paid attention this week to Apple. They just came out, I believe it was yesterday, calling for mandatory climate risk disclosure, saying that this is something that they could support as a major IT company. That's really significant. That represents a sea change on their part. And I think Apple, like so many companies, is in a position of saying, look, we've been doing this, okay? We've been looking at our emissions, scope one, scope two, scope three. We have our strategy. We know what we're doing here. We've got a plan. Why not, in a systematic way, have some uniformity about the way that we disclose with our peers so that investors can, again, have comparable decision-useful information? It's an idea whose time has come, Joan. And again, hats off for all of the wonderful voluntary efforts that have gotten us to this point. It's really time to have something that's more systematic. So that's what we get to look forward to, and that's going to level the playing field.
Well, the other thing that the SEC did was they actually named a head of ESG, which blew my mind a little bit. I mean, talk about a sea change. Hello. It's like creating a cabinet level position for it, you know, the equivalent. So that was really powerful. When I talk about disclosure, I'm talking about climate risk disclosure, but I'm actually also talking about environmental impact disclosure writ large. I mean, you know, what are, I mean, emissions is probably going to be included in it, but, you know, what are, you know, water toxicity and the diversity issue can't be ignored. You know, diversity, this is obviously a passion of mine, and I know you believe strongly in it too, but diverse leadership creates better, more innovative solutions, better solutions, more equitable solutions. And in companies that have more diverse boards and more diverse senior management do better across every metric, you know, from customer satisfaction to the bottom line to staying out of trouble, basically. You know, they don't have the Ann Kellys running after them, you know, or they don't have any kind of, you know, or the SEC for that matter. I mean, they keep, you know, they keep their nose clean, so to speak. So they have clean accounting records. They're clean, you know, they're transparent and upfront. And so it's ESG disclosures writ large. I think climate risk is critical, and that will pull the thread, if you will, and that will pull a lot of these things into it. But I'm hoping that, and I may submit a suggestion that they include diversity in that as well, because I think it's critical. And frankly, the investors who invest in all these businesses are looking for it.
Well, they are. And I mean, you raised the questions that were raised by the original founders of the Global Reporting Initiative in the late 90s when this was born out of Ceres office, which said, hey, we need the full ESG picture here. And we need to disclose the full portfolio of risks that are contained within an ESG framework. Now, we couldn't agree more. That's why we support the GRI. The GRI has just a stunning record. Of course, it moved to Amsterdam and became its own organization. And we couldn't agree more with you. And there are lots of investors who rely on those reports, but understand that those are voluntary. And what's being talked about by the SEC now is a mandatory climate risk disclosure. So you raise the question, well, what else can we make mandatory such that it goes into the 10K? Well, the standard there established by the Supreme Court, fortunately or unfortunately, is materiality. Is something a material risk such that it needs to be disclosed within the 10K? And for years, people argued climate risk, it wasn't really material. That's changing.
No, it's totally material. It's unbelievably material.
But you raise a good question. Isn't diversity, aren't the other elements of ESG also material? And that, I think, will be the subject of an ongoing debate.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So before I let you go, I'd like to, and you and I can talk for hours. I've got 80,000 questions going through my head, but, I'm not going to keep you forever. We like to give our guests, our listeners, career advice, and we focus on mid-career women. So what advice would you give to a woman in mid-career, say 12, 15 years of experience, who, you know, on that level, you have a sense of what you do well, you have a sense of what you like to do. You have a certain level of a network, you're got a certain education. And what would you say to a woman who wants to use her education and her experience to make a difference? She's ambitious, she wants to make money, get ahead. So it's not just, you know, go collect plastic off the ocean floor, though that's admirable. But what career advice would you give to her?
Yeah, well, I will draw a little bit from some of the lessons in Lean In. I think the first version of that did have some general lessons, which were to stand up and inject yourself whenever you can. If you're in a current position, you know, sit at the head of the table, be the one who volunteers to moderate, to speak up, to start your own podcast like you have done so effectively. There is something to be said for simply the standing up and showing up and speaking up for yourself. And that goes from negotiating your salary to stepping up for the lead role, even if it's, and again, the lesson here is to step up for the role that you want. If it's not the role you have, step up for the job that you want to have. Put yourself in the position of confidence, even if you don't have that confidence, you know, act the way you want to feel and you'll feel the way you act. You act with the confidence that says, yes, of course I have this. And then of course you underpromise and overdeliver repeatedly. There's one lesson about be careful what you get good at. So if you're not happy with what you're doing, you really do have to take a risk and be willing to step out of your current role and try something new and then test yourself. And you can do that in your own position. You can dabble in another area through networks and through volunteering and through social media, and then see if that's a place where you want to go. I taught so many law students over the years, and I think the ones who have the regrets are those who maybe were stuck and stayed in a particular niche just because it was a good income or they were paying off a student loan, but it really didn't meet their passion. And I think there's a risk there. So I really advise people to be nimble and open-minded and to make a move when they need to make a move. If they're not getting the respect they deserve, they're not getting the salary they deserve. There are lots of women in leadership, and you can reach out to other women and say, hey, I really want to work for your organization. Can I have coffee with you? Can I talk to you? I have women all the time reach out to me through LinkedIn to just say, look, I really want to be doing what you're doing. What's the path? What are your ideas? And to get there. And given the internet, there's now much more of a pathway than there used to be, you know, even 20 years ago. You can write, you can blog, you can put your name out there in any number of ways to establish yourself in the role that you eventually would like to take on.
And to demonstrate what you do well and to demonstrate what you know, especially if you want to transition into another career, you can use content that you develop on LinkedIn or Medium or whatever to show how what you do in this area makes you qualified to work in this area, right? The other thing that's within what you're saying, but I'll pull it out, is seize opportunities, even if they're not perfect. Because a lot of times, you know, you go for, you know, well, I want to be, you know, and Kelly, the VP of Government Relations. But you know what? Being senior director is pretty cool too. You know? Or yeah, exactly. You know, or being, you know, there's a, I interviewed a woman from a major automaker recently who said it took her 13 years at the company or longer to realize that a lateral move can get her more money too.
Yes.
And position her for climbing, you know, for the next rung also. It doesn't always have to be up and up and up and up, that you can go sideways. I mean, this is what women do. You know, we sort of create this way, you know. Don't say no to something because it's not big enough, you know, kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Because you have to realize there's a stepladder. There's a pathway, right? And so you take the next step and the next step and the next step.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, thank you so much, Anne. This has been really terrific. Any final thoughts before I let you go?
No, just great to talk with you, Joan. And I'm going to keep listening to Electric Ladies. I love it. I will be tuning in to future shows. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today on Electric Ladies podcast. Anne Kelly of Ceres. You can go to ceres.org to find all the amazing stuff they do and have been doing forever and ever. So what are your questions about the infrastructure plan and how it supports the planet? Ask us on Twitter at Joan Michelson and we will get you the answers. We also will have a drawing of all the responses and the winner will get a complimentary 30-minute coaching session with me. So please submit your idea and subscribe to our mailing list to stay abreast of our amazing guests like Anne, our blogs and career advice, and to be eligible for special coaching offers as well. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.